I'm quite optimistic about the opportunity that sits there for New Zealand. We're a small country. We have the ability to be nimble, you know, by the nature of being, you know, at the end of the world. Then I think New Zealand businesses have tended to be able to move quickly to adjust to market signals.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan, and in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Kia ora and welcome. Today's guest is Dean Spicer, Head of Sustainable Finance at ANZ Bank, one of the largest banks in Australia and New Zealand. Dean calls sustainable finance a mega trend, and I ask him in this discussion, how does that practically show up day to day at ANZ Bank? We also go into what Dean is seeing more broadly in the sustainable finance space, including as part of his work on the Sustainable Finance Forum, which was part of the Aotearoa Circle. This conversation was recorded in August 2023 in Mangaroa, New Zealand. I hope you enjoy. Dean Spicer. We are here with Dean Spicer today. He is the head of sustainable finance at ANZ. Thanks, Dean, for being here.
No, thank you. It's great to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to be part of the conversation.
Yeah. So maybe just to start, you know, what is sustainable finance at ANZ look like? And can you give us a bit of your background and career trajectory into this role?
Sure. Look, I probably got a very non-traditional sort of pathway into the area of sustainable finance. I actually went to university, thought I'd be a farmer, and got diverted into financial markets along the way. And so still have a passion for the land, and hence living in the valley with you. So living the best of both worlds. But ultimately, I worked in capital markets for many years. There was a point in time I worked on a particularly interesting transaction. It was a pilot the government ran on social impact bonds. And so there, the focus was finding capital that would support an intervention working with youth reoffenders in South Auckland, New Zealand's largest city. Through that process, you know, I suppose the learning for me was that the transaction was successful. It's now come to its completion, and we've sort of seen some great results. But the ability for finance to be a force for good was something that I wanted to work more with. I think the learnings from that was, you know, the ability to capture impact data and link financing to outcomes. So the outcomes-based sort of approach to providing financing was particularly powerful. And I think we've now sort of seen that applied in the environmental sense as well. And so, I picked up the role about 3 years ago. I'm pleased to say that we have seen significant momentum in terms of the area of sustainable finance. Look, we at ANZ, we sort of see this as a mega trend. I think, the importance of businesses embracing the sustainability of their business practices is fundamental. I think the learnings from past mega trends is, you know, companies that embrace it and get on board, they tend to succeed and do very well. And I think those who don't, I suppose, embrace it sort of have mm-hmm. risks to their business. So I think it's as key as that. And it's probably a point in time where, the momentum is behind this trend, and I don't see that changing.
Right. And for those especially who aren't as familiar, can you describe ANZ as a financial institution and a bit of the broad strokes?
Sure. Look, so ANZ is Australian and New Zealand Bank, Banking Group Limited. So fundamentally a large Australian New Zealand bank, the largest bank in New Zealand. But we have a footprint across 30 countries and been in New Zealand a long time. So we bank the largest lender to most of the sectors with a significant footprint. So certainly we are very much focused in terms of what role we can play in terms of supporting the transition of businesses in terms of their sustainability journey.
Right. And so head of sustainable finance for New Zealand's largest bank, what does that look like practically? Is that like a department within the bank? Is it you're trying to drive change across all different arms of activity? And help me understand what does your role really mean?
Look, it's a great question. So, I picked up the role roughly 3 years ago. We have focused largely on our largest customers, because ultimately from our financed emissions, that's where our largest impact is. And so, and also I think from as a starting point, then you know those larger businesses have had the you know sophisticated teams from who are ready to move forward first. And so that was our starting point. But ultimately what we're finding is, and I suppose if I step back, you know, those early conversations, I suppose the question that came up in the discussion was, you know, why do we need to do this? I'm pleased to say that you know, more recently we've seen a shift and it's more, you know, how do we go about doing this? So I think the why question has largely been put to one side. I think you know, pretty much all the businesses we're speaking to have embraced the fact that they need to prove out the provenance of their products and the sustainability of their businesses. But equally, we're finding that across the supply chain, there is a focus on the products and services that have been delivered. And so therefore, there's demand and interest in terms of being able to you know, roll out sustainable financing across the broader banking system. So for our smaller businesses, we have a green business loan that is available. So that's a concessionary loan to businesses to deliver green assets. Down to our retail customers, where we've got a good energy loan, which is again focused on supporting customers who want to install solar, improved installation you know, support into EVs and the like. So there are products being developed across the customer base, and ultimately I think we're going to see further sort of I suppose mainstreaming of financing. So sustainable finance was a smaller subset of the broader financial system initially, but quickly we're seeing that being developed across the broader banking system.
Got it. So it sounds like there's financial products designed for transition towards more renewable energy. Is that what you also meant when you said green assets? Are there other types of sustainable initiatives around regenerative agriculture, conservation, you know, large-scale landscape work? Like what else is in the purview at this stage practically, in addition to kind of the, you know, the lending and financial instruments around things like solar energy?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I think the market has developed probably from taking relatively simple products and then growing a sophistication over time. So if we think about the New Zealand sustainable finance market, it really started out with larger companies accessing the green bond market, where this financing, we call it use of proceeds financing, where the funding is used for a specific purpose to finance certain assets. And they, you know, in New Zealand, green buildings and renewable energy has been you know, some examples with the green bond market been the start of the market. And then ultimately, we have another type of products that are sustainable linked products. So that is where you know, the company may not have assets on its balance sheet that are green assets. However, they may have ambitions to improve the sustainability of their businesses. And so this financing tends to have financial incentives for companies to reach certain ambitious performance targets. And likewise, some penalties if they fail to meet it. So it's really about trying to align the financing with the ambitions of the company's sustainability strategy.
So if I could have gotten a loan at 10% previously, then I go to the sustainable finance program and maybe I can get it for 7% if I can link these particular types of outcomes or, you know, so am I understanding it correctly? There's kind of financing incentives to drive green outcomes. And if that's the case, like where does that subsidy, if you will, of cost that, you know, ANZ's no longer getting coming from?
That in principle is exactly right. Perhaps the magnitude of change isn't quite as large as that, but ultimately that's right.
10 to so, 9, okay.
So ultimately that's right. The idea is, and the reason why the banks have embraced this type of product is that you know we do need to see action taken, and ultimately as banks, we are being measured on the impact we can have around our business practices. And as a lender, our financed emissions and our impact of our lending is where we can have the biggest impact. So, yes, the sustainable linked loans do provide incentives for companies to meet those targets. They can be around emissions reductions. They can be across the broader environmental, social, and governance issues. So, depending on the sector, you see things like diversion of waste, diversion of construction waste as well. So, you know, quite different sort of targets depending on the industry they're in and what the material issues are for that company. And yes, where does that cost come from, or how does it get met? It really comes off, like it's funded by the bank, so there is a cost for delivering those products. But ultimately, it's sort of seen as, I suppose, part of supporting the transition and supporting our customers. So,
and is that logic? You know, I want to just hone in on that logic, because obviously it's very hard to justify when you're running a company to do something that makes less money, right? So you have to have some sort of reason that reconciles it. You know, is it life on Earth is going to go extinct if we don't all get our act together? Or is it, you know, our shareholders and stakeholders are demanding this megatrend shift into more sustainable finance, and we see this as kind of a, you know, rising tide lifts all boats? Or is it also like, well, we can refinance and package our interest rate, you know, that we're lending from in the international markets at lower rates if we drive better sustainable impacts, you know, on the ground with our clients? Or is it all three? I'm curious, or what else am I missing? Like, where does the financial logic really capture that gap?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. I think you have answered it. It really is a combination of things. So if we get back to what is our purpose? So our purpose is to shape a world where people and communities thrive. So therefore, if we're going to be purpose-led, we need to be able to show and demonstrate that we're delivering on that purpose. And ultimately, you know, our stakeholders are asking the question, so what is your contribution to solving what is a crisis? And so that's really what's driving the action. So yes, there's a cost in terms of delivering some of these products, but ultimately it's aligned to our purpose and aligned to our strategy. And so that's the reason for it. New Zealand imports a lot of capital. We have a large external financing need. That's generally financed through the banks. And so when we go to the international capital markets, the question that's asked is, okay, so talk us through your strategy. You know, what are you doing to support your customers' transition? So I suppose it comes back to that mega trend I talked about. It's really a whole lot of stakeholders driving in a certain direction. And so that's driving us to react to that. The businesses that we're financing, we need to see them make a change. Therefore, we need to provide incentives to drive that. That's really what's behind the shift. And I suppose there's a competition aspect to it as well. So naturally, we're in a competitive market. These products are now available across our competitors as well. And so naturally, not having those products available would see potentially a bank in a disadvantage from a competition point of view.
Right. So you have the international financing and lending institutions, you have the clients, you have the other competition in the market. What about New Zealand government? Like, how much, as a stakeholder, do their policies currently drive this mega trend? And maybe practically, what are those things that are currently affecting your business?
Yeah, look, I think clearly the government's got a big role to play. One or the other, they're a clear stakeholder with the regulators having an important part. Look, when I talked about the conversation shifting from why should we do this to how, one of the catalysts for change was actually the announcement by the government at that time that they were going to make climate-related risk disclosures mandatory. So this is the first country in the world to say, a large number of our customers, all of the listed companies, effectively banks and insurance companies, and as well as asset managers, would need to effectively come out and deliver TCFD reporting on their climate risk disclosures. And so naturally, when that becomes something that is mandated in the future, then very quickly it rises to the board level and something that is an obligation, a disclosure obligation. And that then starts to drive conversations around, okay, so this is something we need to do. How are we going to deliver on these obligations, and what are the things could we be doing? So I think it was actually really helpful. One of the themes that comes out again and again is data and transparency and reporting. And so, you know, certainly I believe that the New Zealand government has done a number of regulatory things that have been helpful in terms of aligning to the change we need to see. You know, it's probably fair to say no one wants to see more regulation, but I think the regulatory levers are important to support the change, particularly if you want to see rapid change.
Yeah, we had a conversation with Jerry Ward from EY talking about TCFD and now TNFD, and yeah, it's fascinating to me because I didn't expect, if you would have asked me 5 years ago where the change is going to come from, it felt more like it was going to come from smaller businesses, entrepreneurial kind of startups, nimble enterprises, building sustainability into their business models and putting pressure, and then the slow big companies would finally move. But it actually, you know, is striking me more and more in these conversations that we've been having that it's actually a lot of the change is happening more quickly at the larger, you know, organization scale because of these different reporting requirements in many cases. You know, here in New Zealand, for example, in the United States, the SEC, you know, also putting out frameworks around climate-related financial disclosures, and in the EU, supply chains, you know, now being mandated to include more transparency and different deforestation requirements and so forth. So, I'm curious, just like within the broad view mega trend, is that, what do you think about that? You know, where are these like levers of change and kind of the energy that's coming in? It's obviously from all directions as we all wake up to the climate crisis, but are there particular aspects of the landscape that are moving more quickly, more slowly, or any other unexpected, you know, surprises?
Look, I think you've captured it well. What we're seeing in terms of larger customers, larger businesses who are captured under the climate-related risk disclosures, is that that is obviously giving them a time frame to which they have to meet. One of the other sort of developments we're seeing is that more and more businesses are setting science-based targets for their emissions reductions. And as part of that, a lot of them are aligned to or having them verified by the Science-Based Target Initiative. So that's becoming perhaps a market norm for the larger end of town. And as part of that, they're focusing on their Scope 3 emissions across their supply chain. And as a result of that, they needed to go out and engage with their supply chain. So I suppose when I'm speaking to small businesses who perhaps feel perhaps this is not relevant for them, you know, if you want to be part of someone's supply chain, then you're going to have to be able to capture your data and your emissions and report it. So I think that the big end of town influencing the supply chain, I think, is an important observation. I am, however, quite presently surprised when you go out and you speak to various businesses how, you know, there's always leaders and laggards, and there's some small businesses who are doing some incredible work where you've got some really passionate people who they get it. But it's just something they believe in, and therefore that belief and that value-driven approach to their business really comes through strongly. So, and that's very true. When I speak to our frontline bankers, you know, across the agri sector, you know, there's some great work being done and some really passionate people in terms of how they sort of see the future of farming, for example. And so, to me, I'm quite optimistic about the opportunity that sits there for New Zealand. We're a small country. We have the ability to be nimble, you know, by the nature of being at the end of the world. Then I think New Zealand businesses have tended to be able to move quickly to adjust to market signals, because ultimately we tend to be a price taker in the commodity markets. And so, you know, I think that presents a real opportunity for us to be able to embrace the trends we're sort of seeing and pivot.
Yeah. And so it's clearly one of those is farming, like you said, you know, and it's a huge part of our economy. What are you seeing in that space? And, you know, what's it going to take for the ongoing transition of farms into increasingly sustainable and aspirationally regenerative practices?
Yeah, look, you're right. When you look at New Zealand as a country and look at our emissions profile, then, you know, agricultural emissions are the largest part of that. And so we need to recognize that. I think, you know, when we look at the signals we're getting, it's clear that, you know, access to our traditional export markets is going to be dependent on, as you say, being able to show that we are operating in a sustainable fashion. And so whether that's driven by free trade agreements or whether it's driven from large commodity buyers, you know, they're sending some pretty clear signals. And so, you know, that has been heard and received well. I think certainly the local producer companies who, you know, often they're cooperatives working for their members, they're embracing that and looking to make change and trying to send signals to farmers early so they can adjust to those signals. So, you know, change is never easy, and I think that's one of the things we recognise. And so, you know, it's a matter of then I think that the process of change is happening, and I think ultimately being a competitive market, then, you know, it's understood that we're going to need to improve the farming practices out there. But I think, as I say, I think there's a recognition that change needs to happen. I suppose one of the challenges that we face is, you know, how do we ensure that, you know, there is a just transition, and that's not just in terms of businesses, but across, you know, the whole of our communities. So that's quite a big challenge. You know, it's not just in terms of farming practices, but in terms of the impacts of climate change. Mm-hmm. You know, the risk is that you know, vulnerable communities can get left behind, and so. Yeah, I don't know that we understand the answer to that, but it's something we're quite mindful of in terms of trying to move at pace and move out the way we operate. At the same time, being conscious that, you know, there are impacts on individuals, on businesses, and on communities that are around that are dependent on those businesses.
Yeah. So is it fair to say that there's a lot of farms in ANZ's portfolio in terms of
certainly we would be the largest agri lender in the country. So it's certainly very important to us to sort of support the process of change that's happening.
Right. And so what I'm curious, are there particular initiatives that you can, you know, maybe summarize around farms who want to go through a bit of a transition, but that needs upfront investment? Often farms don't have the extra cash flow or free CapEx to go invest in some sort of multi-year transition of farming practices into new models. Are there specifically tailored, you know, playbooks, roadmaps? You know, is this something under development? Like, what are the programs or offerings possible in this context?
Yeah, look, I think it's probably is a bit of a work in progress, because I think you know, it probably comes back to that point I made before around what I sort of see as a gap is the data and the evidence that encourages, you know, businesses to change. Because if you're going to change your business practice, then that comes with an element of risk, and so you know, and potentially capital requirements as well. And so, you know, the question often is, do I keep doing what I'm doing, or if I'm going to change, what does that change look like? What's that process of change going to mean? Is it a drop in income through the transition period, and then a pick up again? And so I think what's been helpful is we're starting to see pilots being run and that data being made available for example, Ngāi Tahu, the iwi in the South Island, are running two farms side by side, one through Regen Ag process and a regular farm. And so I think that data is going to be really powerful in terms of showcasing what that impact looks like. And probably one of the gaps in the New Zealand market, I would say, is, you know, so that gap capital to support and transition businesses. So we've seen some of that delivered through, you know, the funding to support transitions from, you know, coal boilers, for example, which has been quite effective in terms of the response from businesses to embrace that. So I think the evidence is there that you know, that sort of transition capital, if you like, or that gap capital, does actually drive change and helps de-risk the transition. So I think we probably need to explore more of that type of approach to particularly if we want to accelerate the process of change, because otherwise you tend to sort of see it as more of an organic change, which is fine in an ordinary setting. But again, if you're talking about a climate crisis, then we really need to see the change happen faster. Mm-hmm. So possibly that's still a gap in the market.
Yeah. And on the farming side, are there particular questions that you feel are the most pertinent unanswered questions in terms of where the data and evidence needs to support? Like, if we were going to, you know, put more robust measurement and reporting into place on our farm to showcase, you know, something. Is it carbon sequestration in the soil? Is it healthy waterway outcomes? Is it animal welfare? Is it nutrient-dense food? Like, do you feel like, you know, given that you have some context around farming and, you know, obviously just land use in general, like, are there particular areas that you feel are the answers are still unsatisfactory to the financial logic that's required that will help to kind of de-risk that gap?
Oh, it's a great question. And I do feel that the data sets are improving and measurement will only improve. And I think, again, if we think about, you know, so there's the data capture and the ecosystems around to deliver that and to sort of aggregate that data, that's going to be really important, I think, in terms of, you know, the future of measurement of impact products. Look, I think what's really interesting and is that we're sort of starting to see the emergence and focus on nature and biodiversity generally. And so, again, that's very relevant in New Zealand, where biodiversity loss by the uniqueness of the species we have here is impacted. And so, you know, which throws up a whole lot of other questions around, you know, how do we capture the data? And it can feel a little bit daunting when you sort of sit there and go, yeah, how do we even start? But I liked the suggestion you had there in terms of about water, because when I think about a good starting point to me would be seen to be capturing better measurement of water volume and quality, because that reflects, you know, the healthiness and the vibrancy of the ecosystem. So we know that water flows from the mountains to the sea, and that ultimately the water is pretty much the veins of the nation. So if we can capture better data from waterways, then I think that would be a good starting point. It then would signal to us, you know, from catchment to catchment, where improvements are happening, and perhaps that lessons can be learned from those catchments to share with others. We now have sort of water sensors that can deliver real-time information. So, you know, you can sort of see that you can get some really high-quality data real-time. So that could be a good starting point. And, you know, if we had nationwide water measures for New Zealand, then, and you know, that would at least give us some pretty good signals in terms of where our problem areas are, and perhaps identify, you know, where we should be spending our time. And I think also from a cultural point of view, if we listen to the Te Māori in terms of the Te Ara Māori sort of view of things, then water is culturally very important. So I think there's a lot to be learned from how Indigenous people have been viewing some of the, you know, nature in particular. While this is all new and feels new, ultimately, you know, there's Indigenous knowledge that I think needs to be embraced and listened to, and we can learn a lot from. Yeah, and going back and looking at the understanding that comes from Indigenous people.
Because I mean, on the water point, like, for me, I've been surprised at how wonderful of an intervention riparian planting can be, you know, planting up our waterways. And clearly this has embrace, you know, up and down New Zealand, because it's been happening for decades, as far as I can tell, and some places have embraced it faster and more robustly than others. But we still have a huge amount of our waterways that our stock are running through them. They don't have any fencing, or they've also don't have any intentional planting around them. And in terms of interventions, it's like, well, it's not rocket science. Like, just plant trees along the river, you know. And yet, it has all of these demonstrable benefits in terms of water quality for, you know, life corridors for birds and insects, you know, protection against erosion, you know, adaptation for extreme climate events. And I guess, yeah, I think about that and I'm like, well, why haven't we done it already? You know, like, why haven't we just planted up every river in New Zealand? Like, ballparking the math on that, that's not an inconceivable, you know, check to pay, you know, whether it's from government or all the local councils, all the community foundations, you know, whomever. And yeah, I wonder, when you get back to that beginning catalyst of your career into the space of, you know, the power of outcomes, if we don't have all of the rivers instrumented and all of the measurements all, you know, firmly in place, like, but yet we know collectively that, like, that's a good activity to do. That's a good intervention. Is there room in sustainable finance for more action and activity oriented rather than just outcome oriented interventions in the landscape? Like, can we get better at designing financial products that say, we know if you do these things, it's good. And so we know that the data it costs money to be on the opposite end of that, you know, the tail end of that to do all the reporting and monitoring and verification. And these tools are getting better and we're getting better systems to do all that. But in the meantime, the climate crisis is still happening. Let's plant up the waterway. Curious how you think about that, both from a riparian planting as an example, but also this difference between outcomes and action.
Yeah. Look, it's really, a really good point. Look, I actually think the incentives are there. So I talked about our business green line that can be used on farm for plantings, as you describe, and there's sort of concessional rates for that. Look, from my own experience down the valley, and I think you're doing the same thing, putting in native trees. So there is a cost in that, and certainly if you have to fencing can be a big cost. Totally. Look, what I've been surprised at is, in fact, the ability to be able to get support for that. Obviously, my scale is quite small, but from putting a plug for the Wellington Regional Council, you know, they've come out, given advice. There is subsidies for trees and plantings. There's, again, trees that count. So this is a local sort of pledge system where people make donations of trees and they're provided to planters. So I don't think there's really an excuse not to have planted out your waterways or your riparian areas. You know, the support's there. Yes, there's a cost, but it's there's also potentially, you know, free trees available. So I think, and to your point, yes, that there are products there that support that sort of activities-based type planting. So, look,
I just want to press on that point because, I mean, for us, we were very grateful for Wellington Regional Council support. Had volunteers from different local nonprofits, you know. I mean, it's fantastic. Like, that's what I mean. Like, people are embracing it, and it's still a huge cost.
Yeah.
You know, and most farms just don't have that kind of extra capital. So do you feel like it's, I mean, maybe it's just like it's coming, it's building, there's groundswell, there's a lot of support and resources, but do you think it's enough? Do you think that, I just want to kind of...
Look, is it enough? No, I don't think it is enough, because I think if you're a farm, and to your point, you know, if you're under pressure because you've got general other issues to address, and it could be, you know, with weather events recently, then you can sort of see what those capital issues may be. And naturally, you've got the volatility of commodity markets, which affect profitability. So, I think there are mechanisms in place, but there's still gaps. And I think it's one thing to get the tree in the ground, and that's the activity, but the outcome is you want that tree to be established and into a mature tree, and you've then got pest issues to go with it. So there's lots of challenges. I think your point's a really valid one, that ultimately there is a need for more to be done to if we want to accelerate any of these actions, and there's still gaps, and so that's without a doubt. So, look, that's probably one of the key takeaways to me when I look around. You know, yes, we're making progress, but it's not fast enough, and so the question is, what levers do we need to pull to speed that up? And so I think that's a question we need to ask ourselves if we really want to see progress. And one of the things that's a little bit frustrating is when you look back at COVID. Then globally, there was a massive fiscal monetary stimulus to address that crisis.
Exactly.
I don't feel that we're sort of seeing the same urgency being applied, and that's not been a criticism of governments generally. I think it's just feels to me as though we seem to think we've got more time than what we really have, and so I think that's probably a big risk to us all. If we don't act now, then it's the problem just gets bigger.
Yeah, because I think that for me is a felt sense of being out here on the land is, you know, at this point we put trees in the ground and I'm just praying that the next season is stable enough that they can be established and grow past those first, you know, couple of years to survive in the ground. And like, will we get enough rain this season? Will there not be a huge windstorm that knocks them all down? Will there not be a drought? You know, like, and as the climate continues to change and we have more volatility and wetter wets and drier dries, like, it's all the more imperative that we do the work now, right? Like, we want to get these things established, and they take long time, you know? Like, you put that tree in the ground, it's like, this is not an instant effort, right? Like, this is a generational thing. And so, yeah, I do worry that sometimes our productive actions and the feeling that, like, okay, we're making progress, it masks the truth underneath, which is the iceberg is really big. Like, we still have you know, multiple generations of industrial civilization to, you know, debt to pay off here? And are we like kind of really recognizing the intensity of the moment? And, or maybe I'm overreacting, you know, like I'm open to all of it. But yeah, I mean, I saw on your LinkedIn that you started with, you know, I was born at 320 parts per million, you know, and it's like, how does it feel that you're working in this field and, you know, at some level, tremendous progress, more people talking about climate, more people financing, you know, here I am wanting to interview you about sustainable finance in the garage here in the Hutt Valley, you know, it's like, and at the same time, like, you know, we're not at 320 parts per million anymore.
I think there's various emotions that come through when you look at some of the challenges we've got. So, and it's very easy to feel overwhelmed and therefore you know, that can actually inhibit action because people feel hopeless and I can't make a difference. So, you know, I think we need to think about that one first of all. I think, you know, it's easy to think we can't make a difference, but I think all these small collective actions we know can make a difference. And so I also think that, I do find it daunting when I sit there and look at the recent weather events and realize that these events will come with more force, more frequency. And so, you know, what do we do about that? So I don't think anyone really knows. I think also, when we think about climate risk, it's probably a risk like we've never dealt with before. So, you know, financial markets, and if I go back to my university days last century, when I was born, but, you know, and I look at those models, they were very simplistic and you know, they basically ignored what was deemed externalities at that point in time that we're now saying, well, no, actually, these externalities need to be perhaps internalized again as we realize that they are true impacts of the business we're doing. So I think we've lived in somewhat of a false paradigm for a long time, thinking that we were accurately capturing business performance when in fact we're ignoring some fairly significant impacts. And so we're only capturing up to that now, and we haven't truly embedded that within in our risk models and financial models. Right. So I still feel that financial markets continue to misprice climate risk and climate change, and so that's an issue that will play out over time. So yeah, look, I think there is a first we need to raise awareness and understanding, and I think that from that awareness and understanding we can make progress. And so, yeah, I think that is happening, and it's happening quickly. And look, I'm still an optimist that, that we will see progress and we will see momentum pick up. Possibly my example of the COVID response sort of highlights that when we understand a risk, then there will be mobilization of effort to address it. We just have to hope that it won't be too late when that moment strikes.
Yeah, or that it won't always be a reaction. How do you feel about the collective response so far to the cyclones that happened earlier this year and kind of some of the ecological damage that ensued?
Look, my first response is probably one that most people feel, and that is, you know, it's devastating, and obviously for the people who are impacted, it's hard to imagine what that must be like. My main concern is that in an effort to build back, we will build back the same rather than build back better. And so, you know, what does building back better look like? I think we need to look at nature and realize that, you know, the force of nature is something that we need to work with rather than against. And so we may need to think about how we, you know, where we build and how we build and there may be areas that we need to leave to nature. So, again, there's been some interesting work done globally on this where floodplains being allowed to be floodplains again, and that's actually ended up with a better outcome for inhabited cities than building up dams and stop banks and trying to control waterways. So, look, I don't know what that's going to mean locally. I think that I get a sense there's significant frustration at the time it's taken to see a response, and the response when it comes probably needs to ensure that we do think differently about how we build back and to ensure that as these events continue to come in frequency and force, that we can we're in a better position going forward.
It strikes me that, you know, nature is everything, right? It's connected to everything, and finance, you know, runs our economy and is connected to everything. And so there's so many different competing possible priorities, whether it's those, you know, flooding plains, or whether it's the, you know, farms that we talked about, or we haven't dove into forests and ETS. And, you know, how do you prioritize at a high level as a bank, you know, which, like, where do you get your ecological information, and how do you kind of make those assessments internally of which levers to pull and which areas to focus on? Is it coming from global signals, from the client side demand? Like, you know, I'm sure it's a mix of everything, but curious just functionally how priorities get set.
Yeah, look, it's a really, really good point. So look, there are a number of signals we get from various stakeholders that ultimately we need to look at. Probably do what we suggest to most businesses. You know, we do our materiality assessment, look at what are the material issues for us, and we look at what where we can have our greatest influence, and that will tend to guide us as to where we can allocate our time and resource. And I suppose as a bank, we you know, the financing we have obviously has an impact on some of these things. So we're trying to, you know, work out ourselves in terms of how do we to capture that information. And this is all new and different to everybody. So we're no different. We're learning as we go and trying to capture better data and work out mm-hmm. what influence we can have. So I think that you know, the banking sector overall has gone through a small amount of change so far. Mm. I see significant change coming over the future mm. years, and the pace of that change is going to change dramatically. So that creates a great opportunity, but also challenges. It means we need to invest more in terms of capturing better data, having better systems, investing in people and know-how. So this is a huge shift, I believe, mm-hmm. to the way businesses are done is done, and because those businesses are shifting, you know, banking and finance needs to shift with it. But it is something which is, you know, it's an enormous change, and excited to be part of it. But it is what you described is something that we grapple with all the time in terms of mm-hmm. you know where do we best deploy our resources to have to drive the best impact for what we can do. So I think we're still exploring that as we go, and it's something constantly in our mind in terms of, you know, the role that we can play.
Are there any other large beachheads? You know, we talked a bit about the energy transition, talked a little bit about agriculture. There's obviously forestry. You know, what about in the conservation space, 30 by 30 coming out of Montreal? Curious, is that hitting your desk much?
Look, it is. I mean, we're very much focused on the role that nature and biodiversity plays. It's something which is relatively new for most of us, and so we're part of some working groups looking at I suppose sort of boot camps to discover how this can play out. ANZ invested in a business, Pollination Group, so they're a nature and biodiversity advisory and investment firm. So we're working closely with them because they've got the expertise and knowledge globally in terms of, you know, sort of being at the forefront of that. And look, I think it strikes me as there's naturally what we call a twin crisis here, right? So mm-hmm. you know, the climate's impacting on biodiversity and nature, and that has a big impact on the environment. So you can't ignore one without the other. And then linked to that, of course, is the social impact that has. And so, you know, we need to grapple with, you know, how do we measure and consider our social and the social impact of all this as well. Mm-hmm. I think stranded asset risk and ultimately, you know, I mentioned the just transition, and by that I mean communities where, you know, people are basically going to be forced out of where they live, mm-hmm. and you know, how do we ensure a just transition, and who bears the cost, because there's going to be cost involved in mm-hmm. Adaptation. And so for an island nation like New Zealand with a small population, yeah, there's some pretty big challenges ahead. Mm-hmm. I think it's that to me is probably one of the big issues that probably hasn't really been truly sort of thought through yet. And how do we finance that? Who pays for that infrastructure if it's going to be an infrastructure solution?
Yeah. Yeah, so that would be things like managed retreat and climate refugee resettlement zones. And yeah, and so that's a conversation that's active, that's beginning, that's
Look, I think there's a consciousness of the problem. I don't think that there's necessarily solutions being developed fully yet. And there's some really interesting and complex byproducts of all of this as well. So, ultimately, you can sort of see for pretty much any nation, you've got some pretty big fiscal requirements. You know, government's going to need to be part of this obviously as well. And so, who pays for it? What is the cost? And ultimately, there's different abilities to pay. So for looking out around at the Pacific, then you can see climate impact is hitting some of our island nations first. And so, we don't have long before some of these issues are going to come be quite significant.
Yeah. Okay. And then in terms of the, my understanding is that you were also a member of the Sustainable Finance Forum and part of the Aotearoa Circle in the development of this kind of sustainable finance roadmap by 2030. And, this was a body of work that I think a lot of leading stakeholders in New Zealand were a part of. So we'd love to ask you about what that looked like and what were some of the observations and outcomes of that report.
Look, I think when you come together as a group to look at something like a sustainable finance roadmap, then obviously it's a matter of where do you start, and it can be quite challenging to get a whole lot of parts of the finance market together who have different perspectives and drivers and try to work through that. But I think ultimately where we did start was, what does a sustainable finance market look like? So what are we trying to aim for? And then work back from there and sort of see the gaps we've got and exactly what that roadmap may look like. I think quite early on, we also recognized that you couldn't just look at environmental aspects because of the fact that the environment and society and the impacts on society are so closely linked, and so there is a social impact there as well. And there's other certain things that drop out of that. So one is around financial inclusion, as well, which is tied into having a sustainable finance market that we wanted. And so we worked through all of that, and we came up with a document, which I think was a great piece of work. But I think importantly, at the end of that, there's a recognition that if we stop there and just produced another report that then sits online for people to read or not, as the case may be, that wouldn't necessarily deliver the roadmap. And so the next step on that was a decision to establish the Centre for Sustainable Finance, which is publicly funded. And that the purpose of the centre was really to focus on the delivery of the roadmap. And so we're a couple of years in. I think there has been some great progress made. I think that having that group there does allow us to check in and just see how we're progressing. Look, I think there's clearly a lot of work that still needs to be done. We certainly don't have a finance place that I would call to be fair and equitable and sustainable. But I think having gone through that process and having the ongoing engagement across the broader ecosystem is really important. I think it's helping to deliver on that progress, although there's still a ways to go.
And you've brought up just transition and the social impacts of climate, and the can't disconnect, what's happening from a planetary perspective and what happens to people. Any other comments or observations from your side on kind of how do we connect this conversation more tightly in terms of ensuring that climate finance, sustainable finance, these types of mega trends are including everyone or addressing those who are hit hardest by the impacts of climate change?
Yeah, look, that's a really good and challenging question, because I think if you look at the products that we have now, there's always going to be people who aren't able to access that financing. And I talked about, that sort of financial inclusion and the need for that. So, how do we solve that and address that? I think that's something that, again, that the group from the Centre for Sustainable Finance was one of our work streams is looking at that. And also those who are impacted by climate change, I mean, there's a whole lot of challenges with that. And ultimately, you find it's generally the most vulnerable who are the hardest hit. So, yeah, look, that, I think there's awareness of that. I think the big question is how do we ensure that those people are supported? And, you know, we've sort of seen from the recent weather events, you know, ultimately there's various support that can happen after the fact. The question is, can we actually be more forward thinking and actually try to invest in the future to try and prevent those impacts before they happen? So, look, I think it's one of those ones where it still feels as though there's probably more questions than answers, but certainly the awareness is there that that's a big challenge.
The final topic I wanted to ask you about, we've been talking to a lot of folks in the Web3 space, you know, looking at kind of the intersection between blockchain, crypto, and sustainable activities. My impression is that ANZ is not, you know, necessarily embracing crypto, you know, full-throated, but curious, you know, any reflections on the Web3 crypto space or your impressions of it?
Well, look, where we have done some work is perhaps around stablecoins, and we recently completed a transaction through an Australian dollar stablecoin purchasing an Australian carbon credit, which had a smart contract embedded in that. So that was sort of looking at the supporting ecosystem to allow that to happen. I think, and possibly taking you on a tangential sort of direction, but I think when I think about the supply chain issues that we see today in terms of and the interest in terms of the integrity of products and services that people are purchasing, that that's going to see the evolution of blockchain smart contracts, where there will be a desire to ensure that when you pay your money that you're getting the product that you thought you were. So there's a whole lot of issues around, for example, food and fiber the provenance of those products and the risk of fraud in the supply chain. So I think some of the development of such infrastructure is going to be really important. And the tokenization of assets generally makes a lot of sense in terms of improving the security of assets and speeding up the ability to transact generally. Yeah, a lot of these things, this technology, I think, has multiple purposes. But when you're looking at the development of environmental markets, where you're going to have environmental credits coming off the back of that, whether that's biodiversity credits or other, then that's going to need a robust supporting infrastructure to ensure that that you're getting what you thought you were getting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. There's a lot in the supply chain side that is pretty exciting. And I forgot to ask you about biodiversity credits. What's your take on this? We're in public comment review, you know, discussions as a country around this, although I think it's been something that's been batted around for some time in the offsets market. Any thoughts?
Yeah, look, I'm hugely in favor of seeing a credible environmental credits, biodiversity credits established. The key to these things is, you know, again, they need to be supported by robust data, and you need the appropriate infrastructure to ensure that that we can capture them and verify them. I think there's some really interesting opportunities in this area, because you know you can have projects invested in that throw off credits that can then be obviously used to support landowners, but also potentially they could form part of a return on finance, where again it's sort of an outcomes based approach, because if the project doesn't deliver the credits, then you know they don't exist. So therefore, you can sort of see how investment outcomes can be structured around these credits, where the credit itself is actually providing the verification of the outcome. It really comes back to ensuring the robustness of the data and ensuring the credibility of what's been produced if we want these markets to develop and have any value.
Right. Yeah. Well said. Well, I appreciate your time, Dean, and looking forward to more conversations like this one. Are there any other final comments or closing reflections?
Now, look, my only thing when I would come back to some of the discussions we had earlier, where look, I think a lot of these things can feel rather daunting to people, and that can often make it sort of seem as though the things that we can do individually don't really make a lot of difference. And I think it's important to to really encourage people to feel that they can make a difference, that the small things we do individually do collectively add up to something meaningful. So, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Dean.
Thanks for your time.
Okay, what'd you think? Leave us a comment below. I find it interesting to hear the perspectives of people working inside our largest financial institutions, especially around topics like sustainable finance. You might also be interested in the conversation we had with Jerry Ward at EY New Zealand, where we go deeper into the climate reporting disclosures and requirements in the country, as well as the conversation we had with Robbie Shingler from Planet Labs. Robbie offers a really compelling vision for how finance and accounting can help drive change towards a regenerative economy. You can find all of these conversations and more at maearth.com. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.